What does it even mean to live a legacy? Often we think of legacy in terms of what people might think of us when we're dead, but then we're dead. We're going to instead explore a living legacy. This is your host, Danielle Strickland. This is the Right Side Up podcast. And this is a partnership venture with World Vision, Strong Women, Strong World. This is going to be challenging and inspiring as we interview people from all over the world in all kinds of different sectors, living a life now that will matter later. A living legacy. Buckle up. This is sure to be challenging and inspiring. And I'm glad you're here. Hey, welcome. I'm Danielle. This is The Right Side Up. And the season is Living a Legacy. We're glad that you're here. We have guests today that are with us. They are smart guys, doctors. We have Shannon Marquez. She's the Dean of Undergraduate Global Engagement, Director of Columbia University Center of Engagement. She does tons of implementation of access and regional expertise and advice and begins, like, I mean, I don't know. I can't even. She's involved in all the things and she's super smart. She calls herself a public health engineer and has much to say and to teach us. She's passionate. She has comes from her own background of discovering her own gifts in places that would maybe normally be something she couldn't do. So she's got this incredible ability. And then we've got Emily Agutu. And again, she's also in terms of water access and sanitation and hygiene, which is sort of this key development, she's an expert, not only logistically an expert, like she's a research fellow, she works at Emory University on research projects, but she's an expert because she actually comes from a village in Kenya and has personal experience with what it's like to be at school and suffering from illness. And she went through medical to try to figure out why she went through sort of a medical path. And then she went to a public engagement path and a community development path. And now she's like really inspiring and really making a difference on the ground in Kenya. So both of these women are extraordinary. They're educated. They're super smart. They're grounded. They're down to earth. They share their own personal stories. They share some of their expertise. I've learned so much and I'm so inspired. And you will be too as you witness or listen to these incredible humans using the gifts that they have and the skills that they have and their great, big, beautiful brains for the good of others. And it's making a real difference in the world. I hope you're enjoying this season. I'm loving it, but you are going to love these guys. So welcome, Shannon and Emily. Well, Shannon, thank you so much for being on the Right Side Up podcast and for being part of this season where we're really diving into the lives of people like yourself who are living for others right now and doing things that really matter around the world. So thank you for being here and thanks for what you do. So glad to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Danielle, for having me.
Oh, it's a joy. Now, I guess I'm going to describe you like my best description of you is just like you're super smart. And I know you're more than that, but you are really involved in research and academics and education and all these sort of things. Can you catch us up from your perspective and your own story, basically how you got to where you are and what you're doing now?
Sure. I'm a public health engineer. I like to kind of coin that because I started out my path in engineering. I'm an environmental health scientist. I landed in public health school because I was really interested in connecting my engineering knowledge with having an impact on communities, families, population health. So I shifted my work to include training in public health after I had done degrees in mechanical engineering and civil engineering. And I ended up in a PhD program in environmental health sciences and engineering at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Global Public Health. And this was a pivotal moment for me. It really is where the dots connected and I realized my purpose. I was very interested in the environment. I always had an interest in water, environmental justice issues, social justice, working in underserved communities. So when I made this shift, it helped me to really connect all that I had learned, all I had done to really humanity, having more of a direct connection. And it's really where I started living my legacy. Against that backdrop, then, I've really spent time shaping my career to be focused on empowering women and girls, training next generation leaders to address global challenges. And I'm particularly focused on the global water and sanitation crisis, which I could go on and on to talk about more. But that's sort of how I went down that path. As I finished up in graduate school, I connected that work to looking at water issues, mostly in the U.S. And then one thing I, you know, thought about it and realized that most of the world's water problems were in other low-income countries, and that there was really this need to address the challenge because of the burden on women and girls.
It actually strikes me, thank you, that was very concise, for I'm sure it was like a lot more. There's a lot more to it than that. But one of the things I wonder, from your own background, like there's a lot of barriers to all women in advanced education. And it seems like that's harder and harder and harder, the barriers. It's getting a little bit better in sort of some Western countries, but the barriers are still exist. Did you find barriers, or were you already just like, were you like always super curious and like you always had this, and were you encouraged in that? Like, what were the challenges to even get to the PhD level to go, oh, this is where I'm supposed to be?
That is a very great question. And so I was empowered because I had the great opportunity to attend a historically Black college and university. And I was in an honors program, the Benjamin Banneker Honors College. And this college was set up in particular to ensure that we were being empowered and introduced to the idea of being trained as emerging scholars. And believe it or not, although I was studying engineering, which I learned later had, you know, a dearth of women, right? There were very, very few women when I went off to graduate school. But because of the foundation I received in that program as an undergraduate, and because I sat in classrooms that were 50, 60% women studying in sciences and engineering. So it really flipped my experience. I, you know, went through my scholarly endeavors and matriculated through that institution, really feeling like I could make a difference in the world and that my training was setting me up on a trajectory for success. Now, from there, when I went off to graduate school, I began to experience the fact that, wow, I'm like a unicorn. There are very few women, and especially women of color, and that the underserved, again, were not represented, and that there really was a need to have more diversity and access. So I felt a sense of pride also having achieved along the way, but also a sense of obligation that I really needed to complete this task at hand because of the state of affairs. And so I did experience the barriers. But luckily, the foundation that I received really equipped me. I was able to navigate that, and I was successful at it. And so I have to credit it in my upbringing and that early foundation I received in undergraduate.
That's amazing, too, that a lot of your work is around this getting very intentional about, you know, identifying women and girls at the center of some of the transformation that needs to happen, and how that kind of mirrors a little bit of your own experience. Like, wouldn't it just just normalized what should be normal? That's amazing. Was there anyone that you sort of looked up to and were like, well, if she can do it, I can do it? Or did you have sort of those people along the way that were like heroes or mentors or?
Oh, absolutely. So back at this small little HBCU called Prairie View A&M University in Prairie View, Texas, which at that time was a very rural community about an hour north of Houston, I was taught by some luminaries that really had left a legacy of their own. One, the dean of the Honors College, Dr. Jewel Prestige, who was the first African-American woman to receive a PhD in political science. And her husband actually attended the University of Iowa in the 1950s, because they had to travel from the South up to the Midwest to access doctoral training. And that inspired me so. I mean, this woman was just very powerful and assertive. She was a true scholar, very meticulous about mentoring us, especially exposing us to opportunities outside of our immediate surroundings. So although I was in this small little college in Texas, when it came time to go off to graduate school, this program introduced me to institutions in the Midwest and the Northeast. I visited MIT and Georgia Tech and Purdue, Wisconsin. And I felt as if, wow, this was a great opportunity and a possibility. It was an eventuality because I had the mentorship of many scholars, including Dr. Prestige, who I aspired to be like.
That's so cool. It's I love that too, idea of like, as people move into what it is they're supposed to do with an eye on affecting the future, which is legacy, isn't it? That now you're like doing the same thing on a global scale. I mean, it's just so to actually think that the legacy that lives to serve others is exponentially bigger than the one that serves themselves. You know, like it's just the ripple effects are so much larger. It's incredible.
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely.
Okay, so catch us up on WASH. So everywhere I read in your background and your expertise and stuff, WASH keeps coming up. And I think people in the development world, and if you have any insight into like water and hygiene and stuff, you know what that means. But I had to kind of look it up and figure it out because just, you know, I'm not super smart. Academic is not my background. So tell me, like, explain it to me so that you can explain it to our listeners. What is WASH? And then this place you're in now in terms of innovation and research, what's going on in that sphere?
Sure. Wow. Well, of course, I'm passionate about this, so I could talk about it and go on and on and on. But in a nutshell, we're focused on universal access and the sustainable provision of safe water, sanitation, and hygiene. And so that is what we coined WASH, water, sanitation, and hygiene. And it's essential, right? We know it's essential to the attainment of the sustainable development goals. Those are those 17 goals that the UN embraced back in 2015. We know it's essential for life, for development, for economic development, for livelihood, for health, for education. Without water and without access to adequate sanitation, women and girls, you know, continue to be disproportionately affected. They're disproportionately affected by poor water and sanitation and hygiene services and facilities. And without safely managed water, sanitation, and hygiene, women and girls are more vulnerable to things like abuse and attack and ill health and affecting their ability to study, to work, to live with dignity. The reality is many women in the world risk their lives to simply ease themselves. Imagine if you did not have a safe space to ease yourself, to use the toilet, and you had to wander and do that in the open in unsafe areas. And so there have been lots of cases where women and girls were subjected to violence. Not to mention the hours of time lost just in fetching and conveying water, the decisions that have to be made about how you're going to use water when you only have a limited supply, whether it's for cooking or laundry, growing a garden. I'm passionate about this because it's becoming increasingly critical to bridge gaps between scientific research and apply problem solving. Like, we have to be in the field. We have to understand and see the context. It's not a one size fit all problem or solution. And so improving global health and addressing the global water crisis, this is what I'm passionate about. And this is what I've shaped my career on for the past 25 years or so now. Early on, as I said, I was interested in water and environmental justice and working in underserved communities. And against this backdrop and with transformational collaborations with philanthropists and partners, I focused much of my career then on empowering women and girls because they're disproportionately affected by this global water and sanitation crisis, and helping to strengthen capacity, thinking about the training of next generation leaders to address these complex global challenges, particularly around the world. But I have to say, we also have issues of access, even in the United States. So this has really left me with a huge task, not just to raise awareness about it, but to also, you know, really ensure that we are developing programs and cultivating a sense of social responsibility among students and promoting civic engagement and global citizenry, and motivating students and faculty to work side by side with communities and other key partners to address these critical global challenges. And I feel strongly, in particular, as someone who works in higher education, in my role as the Dean of Global Engagement and also on the faculty, public health, and in the climate school, that students can be informed advocates. They can really be effective leaders of social change and use the technical knowledge that they're gaining in the classroom to address real world problems in the field at the global level and, of course, at the local level as well. So I spend a lot of my time on that very thing, empowering students.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Again, that's amazing legacy stuff, isn't it? Where you're really impacting sort of the next generation right now. And are there moments like in development, you know, well, first of all, everybody's heard of the dead aid, you know, and just harmful development practices where you can go to parts of Africa and see well after well after well that doesn't work anymore, or, you know, hasn't been maintained or wasn't built with any sort of community development model. Does that just infuriate you? Are there things that you've learned in that season of exposing what doesn't work that has really helped you teach a different way? Are there sort of like pivots there that are essential?
Yeah, I think engaging with and in communities, right? Bottom-up approaches. Because these are not just engineering solutions. Time and time again, as you cited, and we can look around the world and see that you can come in with an engineering solution and it could completely fail for a number of reasons. One, we also have to have the software, the soft skills, the raising of awareness, the educating of communities. But in addition, we have to build capacity and empower communities to also really take this on themselves. How do we hand such projects over? How do we ensure that the projects will be sustainable because there is a future? And that is key, understanding the human resource needs and the capacity building needs and engaging with communities. So I don't get so infuriated because I think I only align myself with people and projects and organizations who are grounded in that. That at the end of the day, it's not about driving in and out in an SUV and bringing in a bunch of resources. It may take much longer to grow it from the bottom up, to grow it from the community level. And that's the key to success.
Have you had moments in your, so obviously you've had these aha moments, like when you got to the PhD and you just sort of had this like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to doing, I've gotten here. Have you had also moments like that in the field where those, you know, that kind of research has actually met with real life? Can you tell me a little bit of that? What keeps bringing you life in this space?
I certainly have. As I think about, you know, again, the 25 going on 30 years now that I've been working in the field, it's been great to see the progress, just to see the evolution of how we even partner. And I guess I can say this safely because I've lived in both worlds, particularly because I was an engineer and then I worked in public health. And I began to have a lens and understand how different stakeholders don't even talk to each other. And no wonder we had such failures under the previous MDGs. And as we moved into the Sustainable Development Goals, it's been exciting to see our commitment to monitoring and evaluating. That means evaluating ourselves, understanding that we have to track our progress, we have to do course corrections. So I've been pleased to be in the field to see that type of progress, to visit somewhere that had true problems that were problematic from even the staff and the teams on how they were doing the work, And then to return and understand that, wow, my gosh, we are making progress. I think this is important because I truly believe that the global water and sanitation crisis can be solved in our lifetimes. I believe that through these efforts, through the way we are partnering, through the way that we are being intentional about empowering women and girls around the world, how we're growing technical capacity, how we're delivering WASHM global health interventions, we are able to cut preventable child deaths, reduce chronic malnutrition, reduce school absenteeism among young girls in particular, and improve the economic livelihoods of communities. And I've seen it in action. So it's been a pleasure for me to kind of see that process, to work with some amazing partners around the world, including World Vision and Drust University and the Desert Research Institute and Sesame and UNICEF and Procter & Gamble. It's been amazing to see what we've done through such partnership, and I'm inspired.
That's amazing. 25 years later and you're inspired. I mean, that's not always the case. So the fact that, and I love that idea, like, this isn't bad news, it's good news. Like, and I love that shift. And I'm trying to remember, I think it's Adam Driver who created this book around a scientific mindset being sort of a really important one for development, just in your life, where you go from this, you give yourself permission to try and fail and adapt. And instead of, you know, just not wanting to fail. And so you do everything you can to kind of keep this, you know, performance up that this is working when really it's not working. And if we could just get into more of a, and I would say academic, scientific mindset that is like experimental, that's curious, that's adaptive, that can change, because you don't see failure as an end. You see it as a way by which we learn and grow. How much has your sort of academic stuff influenced the way that you train people?
Well, you know, I think it's important in particular because in the U.S., for some reason, we've kind of shifted. And when we encourage young people to explore what they want to be, it's somehow disconnected at times from sort of the workforce development issues we actually have in society, the problems that need to be fixed. And so I always like to kind of bring it back down to earth, particularly as I'm training master students who are supposed to come out, you know, in practice. They're receiving the terminal professional degrees, particularly in public health. I like to remind them that this is where the rubber meets the road. Sometimes they'll be in far off places where there's no one else, and you have to get over sort of that imposter syndrome and understand that you are the key to driving the intervention. You may be the difference to helping the underserved and serving the poor. And so I really try to be very applied and practical in my teaching. And it applies to undergraduates as well, because sometimes they're very pie in the sky and I'm all about innovation. But at the same time, we have to learn to also empower them to think about their place in the world and the difference that they can make as well as global citizens.
I'm thinking in the middle of this episode that you're getting that it matters. Adaptability, education, research, even things that haven't worked and how we can adapt them so that they will work. That a research-based approach to adaptive learning in the field, in the work, matters. I mean, this is how we do things differently in such a way that they're sustainable and that they work, and they work for everybody. And so this is what Beyond Access, a program that Strong Women, Strong World really, really is using to help their programs get adaptive and to focus on ways and methods and systems and structures and approaches that make their development actually better. And we'd love for you to explore that, give to that, see how you might want to contribute to smart development. Anyway, that's at Beyond Access. The link's in the show notes. Emily, thank you so much for being here. We're so glad to have you. And we're so glad for your passion and expertise in this specific area. Can you tell me a little bit about like how you got here and why these issues that you care so much about, why you care so much about them?
Thank you so much for having me in here. And thank you also for this opportunity to share my story from where I started from up to this point that I am in. So my story starts from way back when I was born, being brought up from a family of nine people in the small village along the lakeside of in Kenya. And so I would like also to acknowledge that even though I come from a big family, but I can acknowledge that I had some sort of privileges that other people who grew up, whom I grew up with within those communities did not have. So when I was growing up, I saw and experienced people collecting water from far off places. We would walk like 5 kilometers to get water, bring it back home. Nothing like treating water. And so when I was going to school, like kids would get episodes of diarrhea, and I was one of them who would get episodes of diarrhea. And I kept on asking myself, like, why is this happening? So when I went to high school, like I started like seeing the connecting the dots between the episodes of diarrhea and the water and hygiene issues. Then that then drove me to study anything. I was like, I just need anything medical that would make me understand why people are facing all this, why kids are facing all these issues. And that is how I landed into studying medical lab. So I studied medical lab. I took a diploma in medical lab, graduated, and started working. So I worked as a lab technologist for 1 year. But then as I was working, I was like, this is actually not enough. Yeah, there is some link that is missing here. Because, okay, I could see the parasites. And I had this internal feeling that this is not enough. What is it that I can do as a person to help curb these problems? Then as I was working in that field, I got an opportunity to do some research in a local university as a lab technologist. But then when I got in as a lab technologist, there was this group which was going to the field. And I was like, okay, I think I need to see what people are doing in the field. And so I got this opportunity to go with them to the field, and I saw how they were interacting with the communities, how they were interacting with kids. And that is when I said, this is it. This is what I want. I would really want to understand what these people are going through, what kids are going through, how they feel about what they're going through, so that I may be able to help in one way or the other to be in their voice, talk for them in a situation where they can't talk. So that is really what motivated me to stick to my lane. And so based on that, I then got an opportunity to continue with my education, did a degree in community health. Now that I had already identified that my interest was most so on understanding what the communities go through, understanding what people go through. So I diverted from medical lab to community health and did a degree in community health, then moved to public health. So currently I graduated from my master's in 2021 for public health. And so that is how I've stuck into this lane. And so my current role is also informed by those kind of experiences. And I've really been wanting to be the voice of women, be the voice of girls, because again, even though they have these numerous issues and we might perceive that they have these issues, but if they don't talk about these issues by themselves, or if they don't talk about the whys to those issues, then even if we get interventions, even if they get all those kind of interventions and their voices are not heard, then those kind of interventions do not work. So at this point, I'm like, I need to be that voice for girls and women. And also just to not to leave out men, because they also have a great role that they play. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the role that they play is helping to center women and girls, right? Like helping, because it's so instrumental for empowerment for the whole community. Emily, this is amazing because it feels like what started you off, like, so you already have this unique perspective because you were on the ground, like you grew up in a place where this was an issue that affected people, that affected you, that you saw it. And it's kind of like, I love that it's like this curious dissatisfaction with the status quo. Like, you're just like, this cannot be what keeps happening here. Like, there has got to be something we can do about this. And that drove you, you know, this dissatisfaction with the way things were, not just for you, but for others that you felt and saw, kind of drove you to find out more. And I love that that's a real motivator. Like, I feel like sometimes people think they have to be inspired to do something, but I think you can actually just be dissatisfied to do something and you'll get inspired along that way, you know?
And I owe that to the privileges that I had. Looking at, I know people are, from my village, people are at different levels. Like, you would see this group of people and feel that these are very, very poor people. But at the same time, you also belong in that community. And so just having that privilege to be a little bit a step ahead of them made me to feel to have that discomfort in seeing what people are going through. So I owe that to the privileges that I had. And that is also one thing that is pushing me, like, how can I contribute to making other people who are experiencing life the same way I experienced before get a chance to have such kind of privileges? And these privileges, from my perspective, I think comes from education. Do they have opportunity to get education? Do they even have a voice in their households? Do children have voices, or are they able even to speak out or speak up in the presence of their parents? Because that is where it starts from. If they cannot speak in their household, then how would they speak outside their household? And then this then brings in the issues of cultural norms and social and cultural norms. So then how do we break, if possible, break these cultural norms so that women can also be perceived as people who have their own opinions and they can stand on their words?
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that literally is that challenging cultural norms is kind of, I feel like, part of like your story from the get-go. Like, this can't be normal. Like, we cannot normalize kids getting sick every day, or, like, you know, and dropping out of school, and this lack of access, and women and children being unheard in a social construct. What have been the most surprising things, like, when you're like, I gotta talk to these guys, we gotta find out what they really think, and so that I can speak on their behalf in a way that represents them well? What surprised you about that process? Are they saying things different than you thought, or, you know, how, in what way has their voice and hearing their voice been transformative for you?
Yes, thank you for that. Sometimes you go to these communities with a formed opinion. Like, you've read articles, and articles are pointing you towards a specific direction. Just for example, you read an article about a specific community, and there is all these discussions about norms, about patriarchal roles, patriarchy, and all that. But then when you get that opportunity to talk to women, or to talk to girls, or to talk to to the communities, then you get to realize that patriarchy is not even an issue here. And that is really striking because, in most cases, we would go out to the community. We would think that the communities are facing such kind of problems because of a few issues that we've read or that we've thought of or to be issues. But actually, until you talk to the communities, until you give them that opportunity to express themselves, you will not really know what they're going through. So that giving them that opportunity, talking to them, going to the community and with that mentality that I'm here to learn, I'm here to learn from you, I'm here to get this experience from you, like having that opportunity to also account for your own reflexivity, putting aside your experiences and just wanting to hear and wanting to hear from the real people who are going through these challenges is great. Yeah.
So the big surprises are like your assumptions were wrong in some settings. What do you think? Do you think it's just a time issue, or do you think we're also like in the development world, we're so used to coming in and telling people what to do instead of actually listening and learning from the people themselves about what they want and what the real problems are and where the source issues are? And like, what do you think are the obstacles that prevent that posture that you're helping people to learn?
I think the trend is currently changing. The trend is changing now, slowly. I would give an example of one community in my country where an NGO went and built latrines for the community members without engaging the communities. And then the latrines were built and completed. After a year, when they came back, the latrines were still there, well built, but not in use. And when the communities were asked why they're not using the latrines, then they were like, oh, yes, this people came and built the latrines in this community. And then they went, those are their latrines. Those are not our latrines. They did not consult us. So I think what I'm trying to say is that consultation with the community, like involving the communities from the inception, is critical. I know that sometimes it's a little bit challenging to work, like there are layers. We have the funders here, and then we have the implementers, and then we have the communities, and each and every level has their own needs or their own priorities. And so just challenging those and like being outright that we need to consider community needs first. Yeah. We need to prioritize community needs first before thinking of any other thing is critical. And sometimes some of these levels do not have that realization. People might assume that they know, but sometimes they do not know. So the moment you bring this on the table, then each side will present whatever they have, and then you come to a compromise, which is beneficial. Like it's a win-win situation, so it will be beneficial for the upper level and also for the community. Yeah.
Was there a time in your life, Emily, where somebody really helped you understand that your voice mattered?
Yes, and it really took me time to get to that realization. Initially, from my culture, we take vulnerability as a weakness, which is not the case. So based on people whom I've worked with, I think my colleagues really tried to help me or mentor me to see that vulnerability is not a weakness and you can always fall and rise. And that failures are not the end of it. Like we learn from failures. So I would I owe this to my mentors, my colleagues, who really made me see that, okay, I am one of the girls. I am one of the people who've gone through this. And I need to talk about it more so that people get to know that these are the kind of things that other people go through. But then that does not define me, or that does not define that other person. Also, I like using my situation as an example, especially for girls. When I get an opportunity to talk to girls, young girls who are in primary school or what in high school, I take them through my story, and just to let them know that anything is possible. And this is only possible through commitment, persistence, and resilience. Like, you have to be committed, persistent, and resilient to meet your goal. And I like it when they see that anything is possible. And I like it when they see it from me, especially when I'm talking to girls and women in Africa. Just them seeing that somebody who looks like them, somebody who've like had the same experiences like them, can also rise and be somewhere. So I take that as a great example to inspire girls as well.
What would you say either to somebody listening to this podcast going like, okay, what do I do to make a difference in the world? Like, how do I become more like Emily in terms of, even if I've come from difficult places, even with some privilege, but like, how do I keep going? How do I make a difference in the world? What advice would you give them?
Yeah, one thing that I would like to say, I would like to tell people out there is that each and every individual is unique in his or her own or their own way. And once you take in that and acknowledge that you have, you have weaknesses, and that those weaknesses do not need to dictate what you can do. Acknowledge your weaknesses, acknowledge that failure is not the end of everything, and that you are unique in your own way. Then you will be able to go your way and do the much you can. I'd also tell people out there that it is important that you identify your interest, what you are interested in, and work towards that. It doesn't happen like right there, but the more you put effort, the more you become resilient, the more you are committed, then the more you get to your goal. So it's just more about commitment, more about resilience, and more about embracing failure. And finally, knowing that you are unique in your own way and you can do it.
That's so cool. And and the little girls in Kenya and all across Africa who hear you speak, you know, what is the driving thing you want them to hear?
Okay, for the little girls in Kenya, I would want them to look at me if they can, and know that everything is possible. Nothing defines them more than their motivation and more than their drive to reach their goal. And also to note that other people have gone through the challenges that they are going through and have made it. So they don't have an exemption. Yeah, they just have to push on and push on and push on. And also, additionally, I would like to tell young girls that education is key, and education really matters. And so for the young girls, especially who are in these communities where there are sort of practices like early marriages, I would like to tell them to push on and see the need to continue with their education. And I believe that in such kind of communities, if we have like 50 girls in a community who have good education and are able to make it in life, then they can also be seen as mentors by other young girls. And with that, they'll be able to break that barrier.
Wow, that's so cool. That's great, Emily.
Thank you.
Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for your tenacity. You know, thanks for that example. Even that ability to say vulnerability is not a deficit. It's actually a strength. And giving voice to people who are not heard and making that a priority. And then even that being so transformative, you know, the way that your knowledge in that space and posture in that space is teaching others a different way of development. It's so beautiful. It's so important. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Keep it up. We're cheering for you over here.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
No women, no Moses. You want to study the work of God that has liberated women for as long as time has been tracked? We're going to parallel the women in Moses' world to those in Jesus's and in ours. This is a beautiful study. How we envision this working is either to inspire yourself and to challenge the way you think, and actually to give you lenses to see the scriptures maybe in a new way as this liberating movement of God continues to move throughout history, even to current day. This study features people from Uganda working to end child marriage and people in Afghanistan who are working with a fragile context in Hong Kong and young entrepreneurial nonprofits and, you know, pastors and teachers and artists and advocates, Joe Saxton and Tiffany Blum and Betty Lynn Dickinson and allies, Michael Frost even joins us, Noemi Chavez. I mean, this is incredible. And it's 4 weeks long and it's designed to be a group study. Ideally, you grab some friends and you do this together. If you're looking for a guided version of this, we're going to be releasing dates for a guided cohort that can study this together. And I'd love to lead that. So stay tuned for those details. But the Liberating Move of God is available on danielstrickland.com. You can find it there. You can also find it on World Vision. This is a partnership, but it is, I don't know, it's mind blowing. I could take this course over and over and over and over again, and I helped design it. So there you go. I love it. I highly recommend it. And I hope it helps you go a little deeper into the ways and movements of God so that we can join them today. There's still stuff to do. So enjoy that.